This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions, online at www.bgov.com, and of course on the air on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Well, it's been a little over a week since the president dropped his $3.8 trillion budget request for fiscal 2014. His request pretty much lined up right down the middle of what the House and Senate have already adopted. Bloomberg Government's Director of Legislative Analysis, Lauren Duggan, and Senior Budget Analyst Cameron Luthley have had an opportunity to dive into the plan, and here with us now are the two of them. You've written, Obama plan may spur deals amid belt tightening. I guess my first question to you guys would be, we've waited an awful long time. Lauren, was it worth the wait?
Well, there are a lot of details in the budget that certainly are worth the wait, and that many people in Washington were waiting for. I think it's important to remember that the president's budget does a lot of different things. It sets the broad sweep, the $3.8 trillion number you mentioned, and a $744 billion deficit number, which is the amount that would be the shortfall, basically, the government would have between what it takes in and what it spends. There's those big numbers. But then there are a lot of little numbers and little line items in the budget that a lot of people are looking for. It asks for everything from the number of staff members at agencies to how much they want to spend on different federal programs. And those will be used by Congress to figure out how to fund the government next year, and by parties who are interested in those programs to figure out where they need to do their lobbying, perhaps. Or what they might be dealing with in this year's fiscal debates.
Cameron, before we dive into the number soup that is this budget, were there any surprises in here?
Well, there were a couple of things that jumped out. And you have to remember that, as Lauren said there, the budget is many things to many different audiences. So it's a political document,
sure.
First. It's a detailed set of numbers. In fact, more detailed than the House and the Senate budget resolutions by orders of magnitude. Within the details, there were some things that were surprises, like there was a tobacco tax that was going to be used for pre-kindergarten daycare type opportunities for kids. I don't think anybody saw that coming. There were other things that were a little more expected. For example, the military cut the recruiting budgets. Well, everybody knows that the number of troops
sure.
is going to come down,
sure.
so that yeah. makes sense.
Yeah. As we dive into the numbers, so to speak, we'll start off with spending caps. Lots of pressure on everyone for deficit reduction. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars here. And the president pretty much lined up with what both the House and Senate said, with the $552 million.
Billion.
Did I say million?
Yes, a billion.
$552 billion, thank you. $100 million in defense cuts during the next decade. $500 billion more would be spent on automatic spending cuts if they remain in place. What else are we talking about here? It's a lot of if this, then that, it appears to me.
Well, that's sort of the situation we're living in right now.
Right.
If you'll remember, we've been on this program before. You've had others of our colleagues talking about sequestration.
Right.
Well, sequestration happened because Congress couldn't come up with $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction. And the fiscal 13, the year we're in now, those cuts came out through sequestration. Starting next year, what's supposed to happen is Congress is supposed to spend less money than they otherwise would under a budget cap that's in place under the Budget Control Act. Well, Congress has a choice. They can either not do a deficit reduction plan and live with this automatic spending cut, these lower caps, or they can come up with deficit reduction, either through spending cuts, maybe revenue increases, a mix of the two, and then spend more money, or the amount they were originally forecasting to spend over the next 9 years. So there's a real choice facing Congress and the administration here on how much do we spend on this discretionary pool of money going into next year, and are we going to find a deficit reduction deal to spend more? As your listeners know very well, deficit reduction has been tried for the last 2 years without much success. We've had little $24 billion chunk here and there when it came to turning off sequestration for 2 months. But we're talking about having to find about $100 billion each year going forward if you're going to stop these automatic cuts from going into effect.
Automatic cuts obviously impacting this year alone. Where are we with that, Cameron, as we roll these cuts out continually?
So for fiscal year 13, the agencies are in full bore of mapping out where the cuts would fall, who and which programs would be affected, making decisions like how many employees to furlough, or in the alternative, what contracts to modify or and or cancel in order to make good on the law to implement sequester. So at any day now, agencies are going to start coming to Congress with their spend plans, how they intend to implement sequester, and, oh, by the way, spend the money that's left.
Right.
Each of the agencies are on a little different timetable, but Congress, when they passed the full year funding, they said, come back and tell us how you're going to spend the money. And, oh, yeah, by the way, how you're going to implement sequester.
Right.
Whose ox gets gored.
So as we continue down the insight, by the way, you're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests right now are Lauren Duggan and Cameron Luthy, authors of Obama Plan May Spur Deals Amid Belt Tightening. It's a BGov insight available on BGov right now if you want to find out the nuts and bolts of the budget. Let's talk revenue sought, budget process increasing revenue by $580 billion during the next decade. And I think we're cutting, yet we're increasing spending. Kind of a bit of a juxtaposition, wouldn't you say, Lauren?
Yes, but that's the two ways you can really solve the deficit problem. You either have to spend less or bring more in, or do a combination of the two. And the three budget plans we've seen so far take different approaches. House Republicans said, we don't want more revenue. We want the revenue that we're forecasted to bring in over the next 10 years. And that includes the increased rates on higher earners that were put in place at the beginning of the year. Senate Democrats, when they wrote their budget, said, we want a 50-50 mix. We want to get about $1.85 trillion in deficit reduction over 10 years, half from revenue, half from spending cuts. The administration came in with a 2-to-1 proposal, and that's $2 in spending cuts for every $1 in revenue. And the revenue number that you mentioned is $580 billion over 10 years. And they're doing that mostly by changing tax rules for high income earners again. That seems to be the target the administration has gone after a few times here. One of the big proposals, they've talked about it in the past, this is the first time, according to our colleague Pat Dreesen, that they put it in the formal budget request, is something called the Buffett rule, which people have heard a lot about. It's this idea that Warren Buffett, the billionaire investor, people look to him as a very successful businessman, has said, my secretary shouldn't pay a higher effective tax rate than I do. So, you know, Democrats have run with that idea and come up with this proposal that if you make more than $1 million with some adjustments for your charitable donations, things like that, you would have a minimum 30% tax rate. So think of it as you have to do your taxes again with this new formula and this new rate applied to it to ensure in the eyes of this that you're paying your fair share. Now, I don't think Republicans are going to bite on that at all. It hasn't gone anywhere. It's been voted on, I think, in the Senate. I'm not sure it's been voted on in the House or not, but the Senate has rejected it in the past. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Cameron, three clearly different proposals on the table here.
Oh, yeah.
There is no, if history repeats itself, we're in for a long ride.
Yeah, and a bumpy one. Think about it this way, right? Even if, let's say we take a grand bargain that spans 10 years off the table and say, not possible in the current political environment. They still need to find a deal on 14. And October 1, it will be the start of fiscal year 14. And the problem is that even if, for example, if you look at the Murray Senate Democratic budget resolution, the Ryan House Republican budget resolution, and the president's budget request, they all agree on the defense spending level, at least for fiscal year 14.
Right.
They don't agree on the non-defense side. Ryan would cut dramatically some of the civilian agencies. Murray, on the other hand, would increase spending above the caps for infrastructure-related jobs promotion activities. And the president's trying to hit the caps exactly on the nose. But again, it's those higher caps. Well, the law is the lower caps. So they got to find a way to cut a deal. And if they don't do it by October 1, then we start the year with a continuing resolution, and that would have to have across the board reductions in order to get within the caps, or else there's a sequester. So one way or the other, if they want to spend more money on the discretionary side, they've got to come up with either revenues or mandatory cuts.
Moving towards the end of the year, we're going to have that CR. We're going to end up doing exactly what we did this year. This is just me speaking. Hi, my name is Cameron Luthy.
And nah. Here's the difference. The president has put some things on the table in the way of entitlement cuts that have been brought up in negotiations before, but not necessarily included in a formal budget proposal.
Okay.
So, for example, changing the way that the government calculates cost of living adjustments for entitlement programs using a so-called chained CPI mm-hmm. instead of the way it's done now would reduce benefits to people receiving those, reduce the benefits people receive under programs like Social Security.
But it would protect them.
In the long run.
In the long run, it would end up protecting them.
It reduces the drain on the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, that's something that a lot of groups are very unhappy about that the president included in his budget. But it's something that the Republicans have repeatedly said, we want you to put entitlement cuts on the table. Well, the president did that. So
there's a concession.
There's a concession. The question is, from a negotiation standpoint, what is the president willing to get in return for that? Is it revenue side, increases to revenue? Is it spending side, increases in on the discretionary side? In other words, cutting on the mandatory in exchange for increased spending on the discretionary side? It's not clear yet. And it's going to be, as I said, a bumpy ride through the summer.
You mentioned defense programs. We talked about non-defense programs. The entitlement programs you kind of brought up just now with the cost of living adjustments. Let's shift gears slightly and talk a little bit about Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
How is that going to change? Or is it going to change moving forward?
There are proposals in all the budget proposals so far to do something about Medicare. The House Republican one is the one that's the most radical change and probably the least likely to happen. What Paul Ryan has proposed in past budgets and in the most recent one is to shift to a premium support model or a voucher model where people would have more choices, that they would essentially buy insurance under the Medicare system using these vouchers or premium supports. The Democrats aren't going to go there. The Senate Democrats basically rejected that in their budget. Their president doesn't want to do that. What we're looking at, though, President Obama sought $400 billion in cuts from health programs. A lot of that's in Medicare. And this is mostly by changing the provider payment system. So the goal here, they would say, is not to affect the beneficiaries, the people at that stage, but the amount that they're paying doctors when they reimburse them in hospitals and other providers for services. So I would think that is probably where the discussion would be on the Medicare front. Now, you know, some people will argue if you cut providers, you have to somehow affect the services too, because, you know, money, it's still money that's coming out of the program.
Right, right. You may end up with a lesser, a perceived lesser quality of care because you're not paying as much for the higher quality physicians or services that one would have expected. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests right now are Cameron Luthy and Lauren Duggan. We're discussing President Obama's budget, which dropped a little over a week ago. And any other nuggets, Cameron, that you can think of that we want to be mindful of as we navigate the next few months, things that could pop up budget related?
Well, I think that one of the things that people need to recognize, and we talked about this a little bit at the outset, and that is that when you look at a president's budget, there's a lot of big picture, big numbers, the number soup as you described it, but there's a lot of detail within those big numbers. And I think one of the myths that I hear all too often is this expression that the president's budget is dead on arrival. Well, that may be true at the macro level, but at the micro level in the Appropriations Acts for discretionary spending, most of what any president asks for ends up getting passed pretty close to what the president asked for at the end of the day. So I think that's the thing that we should be paying attention to as the appropriators mark up at the end of May and into June on the House side and then the Senate side, looking at A, the degree to which they're consistent with the president's budget, and B, where they're different, and all of which has to be put into that larger context of spending at the higher caps when we know that the law has to be changed if a sequester is to be avoided.
Lauren?
I would agree with Cameron about the details. You know, there's also other mandatory spending changes we haven't talked about here. There's agreement among the House, the Senate, and President Obama to do something about farm programs. In particular, getting rid of the direct payment system that we have now and shifting to a different approach. There's a lot of savings to be had there, and, you know, up to $30 billion, depending on how you structure it. I think maybe even more the president's looking for. But the farm bill debate is something that we were following last year. It's going to be reemerging again this year. There's savings to be found, and there's also important programs that'll be funded once they come to agreement on that, things like food stamps. So I think that, you know, that's another example of a program. It's not as perhaps on top of people's minds, like the tax changes that are here or the Medicare cuts, but I think there are other important things like that to weigh.
All right. And I'm sure as they do pop up, you guys will be back to explain them to us.
Absolutely.
Very good. Gentlemen, thanks again for being a part of the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott, and I'm a little beside myself right now after reading an article, an analysis written by Brian Rye. There are things that you just have ingrained in your mind that are always carved in stone. You only file a lawsuit against someone when you feel as though you have a valid point, right?
Sounds good to me.
But in this case, as Brian has written, drug patents in the spotlight. Federal Trade Commission believes billions in drug spending could be saved if pay for delay went away. And that's something the Federal Trade Commission called it, pay for delay. A drug patent is 20 years. Walk me through this. How it's 20 years.
So, you know, a drug patent, you're right. You know, the full term is about 20 years. The effective life is a little bit less because most drug companies will file that patent application long before they actually win FDA approval and have the ability to generate revenues off that drug. So on average, it's the effective life is more like 11 or 12 years. But yeah, you're right, 20 years from the date the application is filed. And what happens, we have sort of an unintended consequence here.
Right.
Back in 1984, the Hatch-Waxman Act was passed to encourage the introduction of generic drugs. And part of that was to give generic drug companies the ability to challenge the validity of patents held by brand name drug companies. And so a lot of that has gone on. And typically the way it works, a generic drug company will seek approval for their generic version from the FDA and also signify that they're challenging the validity of the patent. They have to notify the brand name drug company, at which point the brand name drug company has about a month or two to then say, well, we're going to effectively file suit, bring a patent infringement suit against that generic drug company. Now, like any suit at that point, it can be litigated to completion or there can be a settlement.
Aha.
And increasingly, we're getting to the crux of things here, there has been a significant increase in the number of settlements that have taken place. And there's also been an increase in the number of those settlements that involve a cash payment from the brand name drug company to the generic drug company, which from a legal perspective, first of all, is very odd that the company filing the lawsuit is also the one making the cash payment rather than the other way around, as is typically the case. This is what the FTC has a problem with, is what they term the pay for delay, or more formally, a reverse cash payment.
So the Generic Pharmaceutical Association says, oh, now hold on a second, this doesn't exist. There's really no such thing. It's not as widespread as one may think, but this is payola, if you ask me.
Well, you know, from the generic drug industry's perspective, and by the way, this is one area where, at least officially, there's complete agreement between the generic drug company and the brand name drug industry. Just tell the FTC to get out of our way. You can't interfere with
leave
with,
us alone. We've got a good racket going
with our settlements. And their view is, look, you know, all settlements have to be submitted to the FTC for review anyway. And if the FTC thinks there's a problem, they're free to bring a case against it and try to block it from happening. The FTC's position is, that's true, but we're not fully empowered to block it, and it would be great if the burden of proof were shifted. In other words, if these agreements could be presumptively considered to be unlawful and then put the onus on the companies to prove that they're not anti-competitive. And that's actually what's at the crux of a case now before the Supreme Court.
Right. This is the Androgel people. What was the name of the company? The Actavis, Inc., formerly known as Watson Pharmaceuticals, suing Solvay Pharmaceuticals, Inc., the Androgel gang. And the crux of this lawsuit is just that.
Exactly. And so just to walk through the situation here, Solvay has a patent that expires in 2020. Watson, or now Actavis, you know, has sought approval and won approval from the FDA in 2006 for a generic version. But at the time, their patent litigation was still ongoing. So they settled that case. And under the terms of the settlement, Actavis agreed not to introduce a generic version until 2015. Now, that's 5 years before the patent would have expired. But it's 9 years after they actually won approval from the FDA. And so, you know, whether or not these deals are good or bad sort of falls into, well, what would have happened? Who would have won if the case had been, you know, litigated to completion? And as you can imagine, both sides have statistics supporting their view. The FTC has some data claiming that, hey, generic drugs can expect to win about 3/4 of all these cases. So these delays aren't helping consumers at all. The generic drug industry points to a third-party study, a bit more recent, saying that they actually win less than half the time. And so in this case, look, if this had been litigated to completion and the brand name drug company had won, generic competition wouldn't come on board until 2020. Under the settlement, generic competition comes on in 2015, so consumers are benefiting from the generic industry's point of view in this case.
There are ways that they've found to get around this, and that's by the brand name company pulling the generic company under their wing and allowing everyone to benefit from the increased price before it actually truly goes generic.
Well, you know, you have a number of things that the brand name drug company can do. They have the ability to partner with a generic company to introduce a so-called authorized generic, right. That is not under the terms of the 180-day exclusivity period that the first generic drug company enjoys. And that six-month exclusivity period may not sound like much for generic companies, but it's crucial because when you're the only generic drug company, you can charge higher prices than you'll be able to once that exclusivity period ends and the floodgates open and all generic companies can introduce their versions. That really drives down the price and the profits. And for a lot of these generic companies, that first 6 months of exclusivity, if they can obtain it, is where they make most of their money.
So which one would benefit them? Obviously, you can take a couple of different routes here. Any generic company can go, oh, you know what? This is patent infringement. Let me come after you and give me some money. Or excuse me, it's the brand name doing that. Or is it best to get in bed, so to speak, with the generic company?
Well, it's interesting. Right now, the generic companies don't have a lot of downside risk from filing as many of these as they wish.
And you know, frivolous lawsuits.
You can get into the validity of that, however you feel. On these issues, but there's not a lot of downside risk. Now, that could change. And one thing that we write about in the analysis is that even though the brand name drug industry is officially on board with the generic drug industry and against the FTC here, it's the generic drug industry that's taking a much more active role in defending this in court. I think one reason that's the case is because a pro-FTC ruling could actually help the brand name drug companies by stemming the surge in these patent challenges, so to speak. Again, right now, there's really no downside risk for generic drug companies. But if the possibility of making a quick buck from these cash settlements went away for the generic drug companies, and given that, you know, you got these new user fees under a new FDA user fee program, it's going to cost $50,000 for every application that they file, and they file a lot, in addition to thousands more in annual facility fees and whatnot. Now you got a situation where the generic drug company might think twice about, you know, whether or not we're going to challenge these patents, especially for those that have, from a legal perspective, what are viewed to be much stronger patents. And under that scenario, again, in the case now before the Supreme Court, if this settlement didn't exist and if the brand name drug company were to win, their patent expires in 2020, whereas under the settlement, they would have 5 less years to enjoy the fruits of their labor.
2007, 14 of these cash payouts. 2012, fast forwarding, you got 40 of them now. What is the president saying about this?
The president, as you can imagine, has come down on the side of the FTC in this. In each of his last two budget proposals, for example, he has called for legislation that would do what essentially the FTC is asking the Supreme Court to do, and that is to make these settlements presumptively unlawful, sort of put the onus back on the two companies who have drawn up the settlement to prove that they're not anti-competitive. And, you know, the OMB estimates that if that were to take place, that taxpayers would save about $11 billion over a 10-year period, you know, again, from getting generic drugs to market sooner because these settlements would go away.
A developing story for sure.
Oral arguments in the Supreme Court case took place in March, and we expect a decision in June, so stay tuned.
His name is Brian Rye, drug patents in the spotlight. He's an analyst with Bloomberg Government. Brian, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
We'll be back next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.